All right, everybody, welcome to another episode of the Bitcoin Bottom Line. This is CJ Wilson with Josh Olsiewicz, and we are going to talk about a host of topics today. It's been very tumultuous in the crypto space. Bitcoin seems to be kind of grinding, you know, along here and there, filling up blocks with transactions. The mempool's full. We got a lot of people trying to, you know, protect themselves and take custody. So it's, in other words, it's a normal day, Josh.
Yeah, I mean, that's I don't want to say it's funny, but it's like, you know, all this hubbub, all this attention, all this years of capital misallocation, we'll get into all that. It's sort of like Bitcoin just shrugging it off. It's like, yeah, okay. You know, it's not a bank run if you have the reserves, because that's the money of the people, right? That's their money after all.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what we're seeing broadly is a massive shake. Okay, we have a massive shake in the crypto industry, because the interrelation between people that have their own tokens, people that have venture capital investments in those tokens, venture capitalists that are giving loans out, people that are taking loans against those tokens, and this whole kind of interconnectedness of various market makers, lenders, miners, all sorts of stuff at the same time. And I think overall, the pain that we've been seeing since the summer, I guess, really, is still in circulation. We still have some stuff like kind of swirling the drain, and we haven't really drained all of that out of the system yet. And the latest casualty yet is the FTX blow up. The scale of the blow of this particular one, I think, is the biggest one. Maybe even bigger than all the other ones combined, I would say. Bigger than Celsius and some of the other ones by a pretty big magnitude. We're talking $10 billion, $8 billion, something like that.
I mean, I think we know, but I don't think we actually know, you know, how big this is. Because even when you like take into account all the coin values and everything else, I don't think anybody knows yet, honestly, the scale. I thought 10 was high, but now seeing all this stuff come to light, 10 billion. Sounds low. It sounds like it's going to be more than 10.
Well, it's a great example of what not to do. SBF,
that's a good way to say it, yeah.
Yeah, SBF was, you know, a media darling for whatever reason, even though he's not necessarily photogenic, but they were putting him on the cover of magazines. They're putting him in interviews. They're, you know, on his case. And then now, like looking back on it, there's a lot of people that were skeptical at the speed at which his enterprises were ramping up. And also the how they were really understaffed, like criminally understaffed in certain areas. And so when you have that combination of too fast of a rise and too much money injected without controls or rules being put in place by the investors, generally speaking, if you're an investor, you're going to like have some sort of say or some vote or something like that. But it just seems like he put a gun to everybody's head and was like, hey, give me $400 million, take it or leave it. And if they didn't say yes, then he got it from somebody else. And seeing these internal communications from Sequoia and some of the other venture capitalists, it just seems like very loose, you know, very loose capital allocation. And they just kind of like paper airplaned, you know, $250 million or whatever it was right into a tornado. And then he took that. And then according to Forbes and some of the other people, he invested it in tons of other companies, which when you're making venture investments, they're not liquid. So if you spend that money in that manner, there's no possibility of recalling that cash if you need it. That's one of the massive problems, that even if he was operating totally ethically, that's a stupid mistake of cash management.
Yeah, I saw a thread today too, talking about that exact thing. Like they had no accounting system, they had no cash management. I'll say I previously was a part of another podcast where we had an FTX sponsorship, and they were routinely 6 months late on their payments. And looking back on that now, it's like, oh, well, it makes sense. They had no books. They had nothing. Like, it's honestly breathtaking when you look at how little they had going on behind the scenes based on what we're seeing. You know, this all could be just conjecture and speculation, but yeah, it's kind of unreal that the money just went in the door. It went out the door somewhere else. It was all commingled in one account.
Just one big money sausage, and it just got churned.
It's amazing it got this big, it's amazing it lasted that as long as it has, like since 2018, I think FTX.
Yeah. Alameda was 2017, I think, and FTX was like 2018, 2019. So it's really only been 2.5, 3 years, you know, through the cycles.
Well, it's amazing it got so big. It's amazing all those VCs did so little due diligence on anything. It's amazing all the people who did do the due diligence that did see something didn't really say anything, at least, you know, loud enough to that it mattered.
Mm-hmm.
You're hearing all these people like sort of say, oh, yeah, he pitched us this and we told them to do this and they told us no. So it's like, okay, well, that seems like a red flag. Maybe we should in the future bring these things up. You know, that's, but the shocking part is people looked at like Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos. People looked at like Mt. Gox and all those things that you sort of knew were coming. Whereas this FTX thing to an outsider, and I'm like, we were like in, I don't know about you, if you've heard anything prior to this specifically about SBF and FTX, but we're in it every day. And I was blindsided by it. Like I knew they were doing some like shady things at Alameda, but I didn't know it. I don't think anybody really knew what was going on over there, right?
Right. So I think there's a lot of people that were skeptical at the speed because there's just it was inorganic. And I think the life lesson here for a lot of people that are brand new to the space and not, you know, kind of, I would say, you can distinctly put different eras on the Bitcoin space so far, right? You can say the people that were actually a part of Mt. Gox, creditors, Mt. Gox, or people that lost money in Mt. Gox. Then you can say the people that kind of came in after that, but before Bitcoin hit $1,000. Then you can kind of say, oh, what about the BitConnect like scam, that thing, block size wars? You know, there's these different like really big events in the sort of history, even in the, it's only a couple of years, you know, you have Silk Road, all this other stuff. I would say that this one is going to go down as a really big one, but almost for an ironic reason. They literally had no Bitcoin. That's, to me, the funniest part. Is that FTX literally had no Bitcoin. They're out there sponsoring all this other stuff. They took down Tom Brady and Giselle. You know what I mean? They had all these other sponsors, you know, they're sponsoring all these things, you know, the Miami Heat Arena, MLB umpires. Ironically, there's this sort of degenerate car rally called Gumball, and they were sponsoring Gumball. But I wonder if it's kind of like you said, where they were these promises that were put out there in writing, and then the money never came in. That's like, and no one really wants to go public as the one that says, "Hey, I'm in the abusive relationship with a sponsor that's not paying me." Right? That's like a kind of a wacky thing. So I think overall, this is great for the space because it's, and we're seeing that on the mempool right now. We're seeing that there's more on-chain Bitcoin usage. There's tons of people doing transactions, tons of people taking their Bitcoin off exchanges. And it just really, now we keep driving the wedge in between Bitcoin and crypto. And I think there's some companies that are sort of hedge funds and stuff like that, that are going to really have to think about how well, or, you know, that other crypto company or that crypto trading desk or that lending firm or whatever, how well all that's actually being run like a real business, because it has to be. You can't just pony up imaginary tokens and then pay people in that, and then that just doesn't work. So
I don't want to victim blame here, but much like previous examples of people like double booking collateral, or in this case creating FTT tokens out of thin air and using that as collateral, like some of these lenders that are going down now, I'm not going to name names, but some of them that are in trouble, you know, it's like, what were you thinking?
Right,
that's part of it.
And it's like obviously I'm in the car business, and you know, there's a difference between getting a loan on a brand new car and getting a loan on a 10-year-old Chevy Silverado, right? There's a difference between going to a dealership where you can buy the car and get a loan from Bank of America, and then there's a difference between getting a loan from the car dealership itself as a buy here, pay here. So what I'm trying to say is there's like risk with all this stuff, and people just, they don't think about what the risk is. And this is an introduction for a lot of people with counterparty risk. Counterparty risk in the crypto space is the operator of the exchange. It's the CEO or the development team behind the token, the founders. It's how the pre-mine release schedule or whatever it is. And we've seen that with Solana. We've seen that with some of these other ones where they've had massive issues with chain halts, because of dev problems or just scale problems,
validator problems,
validator problems,
reset yeah. over Discord because that's how they communicate. Like it's right. comical.
So centralization is the key risk. Yeah. You know, the yeah. Oracle problem that we talk about with like when you're taking a real life thing and then you're trying to translate the real life thing into a blockchain. That problem is never going to solve itself. It's always going to be a problem because you have to have people, human intermediaries. And this is the perfect example. This guy holds himself up as like this, you know, beacon of altruistic donations and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, he's vegan because animal suffering or whatever. And you could pick on 50 different things about this guy. But I mean, when it comes
to the confidence game was enormous.
Yeah.
The media was enormous. It's still enormous to this day after all this event happened, which is it's breathtaking to see pieces in like New York Times saying nothing about the criminality elements, asking about how he feels and how he's sleeping. It's like, what is going on? I feel like right. I'm in upside down world or something. Like
because you see that there's a, you know, there's a lot of money at stake, there's a lot of money on the table, but the thing I was leading to is that nobody can be trusted with your money indefinitely, and nobody can be entrusted with an indefinite amount of money. Once you get above a certain level, people are tempted. That's literally like one of the first lessons of humanity is temptation is a path that is very close to us. Yeah. And it leads us down a path. It leads us down expulsion at some point, right? So no, I'm not trying to draw too tight of a parallel to this with any biblical stuff or whatever, but it's a sort of allegory to say that, hey, listen, you guys put this guy in the front of magazines, you put him in front of Congress, you have him hugging congressmen and stuff like that, donating lots of money, he's a great guy or whatever they're saying. And then it turns out that his girlfriend is a degenerate trader and she's a bad trader and just took increasing risks and just blew everything up. And the only solution that he had was like, oh, well, we've got all these customer deposits, let's just slide that over into what we owe. The lending problem in crypto is one of the biggest problems. And I don't know, that's like you were kind of alluding to it. People have been lending lots of money. There's a lot of money in outstanding credit lines, loans. You know, I've been approached as a miner. People want to lend me money. And I'm looking at the interest rate going like, dude, if Bitcoin dips and I'm paying 15% interest, how am I going to survive? I'm basically going to mine for 90 days and then all my shit's going to get repossessed. You know, it's just crazy. Terrible idea.
Yeah. The loan stuff, the interconnectedness of the loans and like the collateral elements, like using a volatile piece of collateral as your loan, like just it defies any risk in any degree that people like common sense would think about. But in crypto, it's like, yeah, sure. You want to use FTT as collateral? Go ahead. And we're seeing that all unravel and unwind now. And really, like you said, all of this is sort of interconnected with the Terra Luna UST stuff that happened 200 days ago. You know, we're finally seeing it blow up. And
right.
And SBF, FTX, Alameda may have gotten away with all of this if we were headed higher than we are now price-wise. Because
If this is a bull market and the same type of thing went up, we'd be 5 to 7x the amount. It would be 50 billion or something like that, right?
Right, so. But nobody would have known, and they may not have blown up if we were in a bull market. You can say the same thing about Enron and Madoff and like anybody else, right? But it's interesting that they blew up at sort of post-bottom, like after all the action already happened, right? Like,
yeah.
And we were starting to turn a corner price-wise. And then they blow up. So just, well, the timing is super interesting.
This is how I look at it, right? Somebody like you, like Doquan pulled the pin and somebody else grabbed the grenade and fired it, right? The grenade goes over into the tree line somewhere and you hear the first thing blow up and you're like, okay, whoa, that was a big deal. Like this dude's wrecked, 3R's capital's wrecked, like whatever it is. And then it's like, hey, what's over there in those trees? And then all of a sudden you hear a second blow up and a third blow up and these explosions going on. And it's like, oh, I think that's a fireworks factory over there. You know what I mean? And that's where we're at now, where we're seeing these like something blows up and it catches other stuff on fire. And then that's and it's going to have to burn itself out. At the end of the day, there isn't like a quick fix for this because of the interconnectedness.
Well, and there's no central bank bailout. There's no crypto central bank. There's no lender of last resort. People thought it was SBF. They we're mistaken and or incorrect, obviously. Maybe it's CZ, but I don't want to hold CZ up on this pedestal.
CZ is too much of a businessman to endanger, because listen, this is not the time to be overextending yourself and taking undue risks. That's just not what's happening right now. And I think if you look at it from a roach mentality, how do I survive the apocalypse, you'll be fine. And the way to do that is keep your head down, stay humble. If you overextend yourself in this type of volatile, like, downward chop, you could get your hand, you just lose your arm. Like, reach out.
I feel like there's not category five. What's the hurricane scale?
Category five is like the top one.
Yeah, there's like a category five hurricane. And like, as Bitcoiners, we're like in the ocean underneath, like, I don't know.
We're in the basement for sure. Yeah.
We're in like the Mariana Trench. We're just chilling, you know?
Yeah. But
there's this crazy thing happening and it doesn't really affect us directly. It certainly affects us indirectly.
Yeah.
Industry sentiment, trust in the industry, that sort of thing. But like you said, look at the mempool. Like, everything's working fine. The chain is working fine. There's been no issues anywhere. People have been able to withdraw their funds from exchanges that had funds actually to withdraw, you know, where there was a bank run. You know, Gemini's had issues with their earn program, and you know, there's issues still going on. But at the end of the day, these aren't crypto issues. These are centralized exchange issues, you know.
Yeah, these are operator issues, which is different than a technical issue. And so, you know, one of the things that's really, I would say, different from a bank in the crypto space, especially with Bitcoin, is there's no stopping the Bitcoin, you know, chain. It's just going to keep moving, and you can keep doing transactions and place your transactions in the mempool and they will just get picked up eventually. That's
just 24/7, baby.
24/7. There's no Monday through Friday
business day. What is a business day?
No holidays. And so from a trading perspective, I do want to touch on this for something, because this is something that I think a lot of people need to understand. There's lots of bank holidays, right? And when your bank holiday is on a Monday, or a Friday or whatever, our most recent one was on a Friday, you have issues sending dollars into your account to cover your leverage. So if you have a leveraged account where you're borrowing against your position, collateralized loans and stuff like that, you're going to have a liquidation risk. Okay, so everybody that takes a loan out on their stuff has a liquidation risk. The problem is if you have the liquidation engine at running too fast, then you can have a really sharp spike downwards, your position gets liquidated, it instantly bounces back up, and then you're left with nothing because the speed of that. And I know that BitMEX has been sort of famous for having that, and people are worried constantly that in the futures market for Bitcoin or in the, you know, leveraged, you know, market, that there's people out there hunting liquidation positions because that's like a jackpot, right? So because you can't stop Bitcoin and a lot of these other, you know, the settlement speed for some of these other transactions or some of these other coins is very fast. So when there is a bank run, it's like a flash flood. They just go, yeah, zoop, and they can't, unlike Bank of America. If I show up to Bank of America at 4 o'clock on a Friday, they can be like, hey, listen, we've only got $20,000 cash on us. It was a busy day. Can you come back tomorrow or Monday or whatever? But like, people don't have that expectation. If I go to withdraw money out of an exchange account, like, I'm expecting it to be gone. If I send crypto out of that exchange account, I expect it to be gone instantly. And so that speed is, if you know, there's like this weird kind of wave profile where you have a bank holiday, right? You have negative price action, and then you have a clogged mempool. So then that's like the liquidation equation, right? Where someone's going to get wiped out over the course of a weekend. So, I mean, imagine, like, your only benefit, the only way you could solve that theoretically is if you had a regular, you know, fiat bank account, and you literally went there and just deposited cash into the ATM and then linked your account to your exchange account to like do it. But just like, if you're at the point where you're doing leverage, like, that's impossible because you have to have such a big account, right? So I think there's a lot of pain that we're still going to see, because there's always going to be the guy that runs out the door thinking we're safe from the hurricane, and then he gets impaled by the tree branch or gets hit by the cow that's still sort of like circling around. And I think that's where we're at. The Bitcoiners are kind of like, hey, let's send out some other guys. Let's just look out the window, because we're fine. We don't need to rush out there. We're not trying to prove anything to ourselves.
Well, I saw Ledger, the hardware wallet company, had a record sales week or day or whatever it was, right? Which I assume is true because it makes sense. You know, we're not really seeing selling pressure because we'd see that at price.
Yep.
What we're seeing is people take their crypto, take their funds and to get them off the exchange. So this is like, what's the expression? This is like them saying, look, I trust the crypto, fine. I trust Bitcoin, fine. I'm looking at the graph right now from Glassnode. It's 100,000 BTC difference between November 8th sitting on exchanges and today.
So literally in less than 10 days, we've seen 100,000 Bitcoin come off exchanges.
Correct.
That's a lot. That's a lot of Bitcoin. I mean, that's, we talk about it all the time that I guess maybe there's like a round number that we can say like a sailor amount or whatever, because sailors got over 100,000 Bitcoin. That's like all of a sudden a sailor just goes and just pulls it off. And I think there's been people, whether it's, you know, Will Clemente or Dylan LeClaire, one of these like analyst types of guys that publish this stuff all the time, you know, they've been sort of bullish on the lower liquidity of Bitcoin, right? So the lower Bitcoin's liquidity is, typically you'll see more buying pressure increase the price. But I think what's, like you're saying, the whole crypto market kind of bottomed, you know, Bitcoin bottomed, I feel like a month or two ago, and it's just sort of been kind of stuck in that range. It's been range bound for a little while. And what we're seeing now is, you know, the flat line of trades, people are kind of like buying and selling a little bit. But it's really just the shrimp and the guppies accumulating their $20 here, $50 there. And that's something that's, I was looking at on Glassnode as well, that it's like the people holding less than one Bitcoin, you know, like how that's kind of creeping up, and that's really mass adoption. Those people that are staying kind of stacking a little bit at a time. That gives me a lot of hope that we're doing the right thing. You know,
and, yeah. We're not seeing what people need to take away from all this. We're not seeing people just leave the ecosystem. We're seeing people do what they, you know, maybe should have been doing initially anyway, is not treating exchanges as a bank, taking stuff into self custody. It's not easy. Not everybody wants to do it. Mm-hmm. It does have a risk, right? But at least people are understanding the importance of what we're dealing with here.
Yeah. I think that's something. So I recently went to the Pacific Bitcoin Conference. I got to speak there on regulation and, you know, the sort of general question was, is the government going to overregulate Bitcoin? Are they going to try to regulate crypto into the ground? And I think what we've seen here as a perfect example, I'm glad we talked about it first, is literally market dynamics playing out. You're seeing a bad actor or a bad business model or whatever, it gets wrecked. The people that are participating in that, they experience pain. The market absorbs all that and then continues to kind of go along. And that's kind of the cycle. That's the full capitalism cycle. So what happens is when there's no bailout or buyer of last resort, that whole process resolves itself very quickly. And if you think about all of the bear stuff that's happened from the Luna blow up till today, it's really only been a couple months that all that stuff's happened. And we've seen a lot of value get wiped out. But like you said, the broad market is still operating. There's still people buying and selling. There's still people trying to work on arbitrage trades. There's still people accumulating. There's still miners mining, nodes validating. There's still this stuff happening. So it really does make my job easier when I go to DC to talk to somebody. I can say, hey, listen, here's the market data, right? Like you're saying, there's Bitcoin coming off the exchanges, you know? There is a pile of transactions happening every day. There are, you know, there might not be as much value in US dollar terms because the dollar, by the way, has been crazy the last 6 months. It's been like just totally ripping, right? Yeah. But Bitcoin itself, which is what we advocate for, you know, it has been safe. It's been fine. As long as people have their own Bitcoin, like we tell them to do, then they'll be okay, you know? And you can do what you want with it. You can put it on different wallets. So you can send some here and there. And I think the use case for Bitcoin continues to prove itself like a tortoise, you know, one plodding step at a time. And the crypto hare is like, yo, NFTs, bro. And like, yo, this, yo, that. And then it's like, it takes a nap and then it goes in parties in Vegas and then it falls asleep. And so it just is like the oscillations of all the, you know, altcoin activity versus the sort of steady climb of Bitcoin. It seems that the very, very old allegory of the tortoise and the hare is going to play out the same way. And the Bitcoin tortoise, or the Bitcoin stackers, or whatever you want to call us, we're going to be fine. And then we're still, you know, for better or worse, a lot of us are stuck in fiat jobs earning dollars. But that's okay also, because we're not in a position yet where people can just go 100% Bitcoin with all of their money. You know, as much as we want to say that, it's like, you know, hey, the stock market's still out there trading. There's still cars, there's still gas prices, there's still all this other stuff that we have to, you know, we have to pay fiat for somehow. And when you have a centralized service, whether it's a credit card or whatever, that's relying on people, you know, you're vulnerable. And the more centralized services you are tied into, the more vulnerable you are in the crypto space. So,
yeah, I think there's no doubt we need increased regulation in the US. But the question, I think, is what could have US regulators actually have done if this activity was offshore anyway? You know, this was mainly, yes, Alameda was probably registered in the United States, FTX US, obviously here, implicated in this as well, a little bit based on what we're seeing with their activities and lending to FTX International. But at the end of the day, can't this all happen again potentially if it's all on international territory? You know,
I mean, I don't know if they're ever going to be able to break up Giselle and Tom Brady again, you know, like on that level. I don't know if there's another couple that's going to get exposed to the cryptosphere this way, that everybody sort of loves, and now they're getting divorced, which is sad. And as a ex-athlete married to a Brazilian ex-model, you know, my wife and I had this conversation today at breakfast, and we were trying to, like, you know, play it out and see why things are happening. And it's just kind of funny. But to be real, okay, here's the question. FTX was a worldwide entity, not a just US entity, right? So, but Sam, or, you know, FTX or whatever, was making political donations to the tune of $40 or $50 million to American politicians.
Yeah.
So, okay, here's the thing. No one's asking questions about the sources of those funds, because political donations are kind of like on-chain data. Like, you have to register and KYC everybody. So if I give, let's say you're going to run for mayor, right?
Okay.
If I want to sponsor your thing, and I give your campaign $10,000, mm-hmm. like, you have to register me as a donor. You know, that's how it goes. And that's like all this campaign financing thing, ironically, is another side door into the, I guess you would call it the prosecution or whatever that's possible. Because if he took customer money,
yeah,
and slid it across to some of these political donors, that's an extra layer of law breaking, which is funny. And then that might rope other people into it too. So I'm not here to say that regulation is good or bad. What I'm saying is that with political involvement, meaning political donations, you're going to have more scrutiny.
Yeah.
And the more scrutiny you have, the more things are going to come to light. And like you said, this is not even close to being totally unwound. There's so many stories going back and forth. All I can say is,
do you know Madoff, by the way? The Madoff stuff is still being unwound today.
Oh my God.
Dox, 10 years later, not yet unwound. Sorry,
right. Right. Well, no, listen, we've already cast the movie. We got Maisie Williams from Game of Thrones as the girlfriend. We got Jonah Hill as Sam Bankman-Fried, you know what I mean? With some hair dye. Then you got, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You got Willem Dafoe as Gary Gensler. You know what I mean? Like, we got a whole thing going here. We got a whole squad ready to go. It would just be really funny if we could get Ken Jeong to play CZ, you know? That would be great. You and I can play ourselves, of course.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Look, if they ask me, I'm ready to, you know, make that appearance.
We'll just write the movie, dude. That's what I'm saying. It's sensational enough that it's just, the story is good enough that we can get it going. I think that's what we need. Like, honestly, I think Bitcoin does need its Hollywood moment.
Well, this is the crazy part.
It's all true. That's the crazy part.
Well, that's as well. Who's the Flash Boys writer? I'm blanking on his name. This famous financial author was following around.
Oh, Michael Kelly, right? Is that his name?
Michael something. I don't know why I'm blanking.
It's the guy that wrote...
Michael Lewis.
Michael Lewis, yeah. Yeah.
He was following around SBF for months.
Like 6 months.
Yeah. So, like, the stuff that's going to come out of this is going to be phenomenal.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's okay. Listen, Bitcoiners, like you said, we're so deep in bear territory. I think like emotionally it's because we're so skeptical of the broad system, right? So we're skeptical of the IMF. We're skeptical of the WEF. We're skeptical of the Fed, the Treasury, you know, Main Street banks, Wall Street banks, whatever. We're skeptical of all that stuff. So we tend to be a little bit more methodical. We tend to be more under control, less risky. So, you know, when things blow up, I think it's like I can speak for myself personally because I trade, right? So I have an exchange account that I trade actively, but like the percentage of my Bitcoin that's, or dollars that my trading volume that's there is so small versus my cold storage stuff that I'm like, okay, if that exchange craps out, yeah, I'll be in pain, but like, it's not that bad, right? I think it's the opposite for, let's call it crypto people. And oh, so sure. They're much more like getting blown around like tumbleweeds right now. And we're, our roots are so deep and dark and like so hunkered down in the reason why we started, you know, like I would say buying Bitcoin or believing in Bitcoin in the first place is because we distrusted the system. And so we're not going to just turn right around and trust a new system. That would be stupid. So it's like the, like I said earlier, but the tortoise thing. Like the safer you are and the more methodical you are with everything about your finances, then the less pain you're going to experience. You might have FOMO every once in a while, but like FOMO is a total illusion that suckers people into getting wrecked. And this is the perfect example of that, where VCs were having FOMO. They were like, oh God, Sequoia's in. We got to go in too. Here's 100 million. And I mean, it's just funny to think of like how much capital was deployed irresponsibly. But I think that's the thing where you have an American VC giving money to an offshore exchange, right? So then that's a potential, let's call it funnel issue or something like that with, you know, the SEC. And then you have the, well, let's call it consumer protection. I'm not going to name the entity, but let's just say that's a consumer protection issue to a degree. And you have all these other, I don't know, like the political donor connection and all this other stuff. So there, I think there's a lot of like tubes or pipes or whatever that kind of.
They're already going to have a hearing in December, apparently, which right. shocked me.
But yeah, there's a lot of good. Money. There's money that might be theoretically be going offshore, but then it's coming right back. So I think there are some let's call it like, grappling points where, you know, the legal team from the government is going to sort of hold on to those and pull them down. I do think that the Lummis-Gillibrand bill would have, like, if it would have been addressed, it would have been a lot clearer. And here's why. It would have allowed us to look at the FTT token with massive skepticism as an industry to say, hey, listen, they're propping their entire trade desk up with fake tokens. And the reality of that, you know, obviously we can see what the risk of that is. And so I think that'll be a precedent that's
a risk of any centralized. Yes, they can use it as their own printing press, but that's also a risk of any centralized coin. You know, I view the same with BNB or with Huobi token, or, you know, it doesn't matter, whoever it is, exchange token.
Right.
That's always going to be an issue, because if sentiment turns, you know, on that exchange or the CZ or whoever the figurehead is.
Yeah. And it happens fast. It happens very fast.
It happens in a day. I mean,
well, and if there's enough, let's say there's enough supply of one of these exchange tokens, right? When they trade against BTC on that exchange, because obviously they could trade against a stable coin or they could trade against BTC or maybe even ETH or whatever. But when you're seeing like the BNB BTC trade volume above a certain level, that just makes you wonder, okay, net sellers, net buyers, why are people buying BNB if they're not, you know, instead of BTC? Why are people selling BNB, right? Is that, like you said, a lack of faith in the exchange? Is that a, you know, just strictly a trading game? Because, I mean, for me, I know that there's been times when BNB over short periods has outperformed Bitcoin and allowed people to sell their BNB for Bitcoin and sort of like, you know, stretch that delta. So there's so many different possible strategies and scenarios, because you don't really have these other ratios taking place inside of, you know, traditional exchanges. What I mean by that is, if you have an international broker's account or like Robinhood or whatever, you're not necessarily trading a ratio stock of Apple to Microsoft. You're not trading a Apple to gold, you know, there's not like these trading pairs, whereas in the crypto world, you can sort of plug these things in however you want. So if you're an exchange, you can create a ton of volume by pairing these coins against Bitcoin, against ETH, against USDT or USDC or whatever. And so that's really where I would say that we're back to the business model. Why is this exchange working? Why does it work? How does it work? How do they make their money? And if you have people like Kraken and Binance and Huobi and some of these other ones, or OK Exchange, if they're doing this thing where they're saying, hey, these are our reserves, right? We're putting it out there.
Proof of reserves, yeah.
Yeah, that's a step forward, right? But I still think that there's a benefit to being skeptical about every coin, you know, if you're an investor or if
you're... But this is another thing about, back to FTX, they didn't have a cold wallet. People were looking for one. They couldn't find it because it didn't exist. There was no cold wallet.
Yeah, and then they had $1.5 billion of Bitcoin liabilities and zero Bitcoin. You know, it's crazy.
It's just funny, like, to live through Gox. Obviously, you could see all the tokens that haven't moved on chain still, right? Living through like the Bitfinex hack and seeing all those coins move around, seeing the Bitfinex cold wallet, seeing the Tether reserve wallet, like seeing all this stuff. Being able to investigate it yourself, and then you look at FTX situation right now, it's like, what is going on?
How did he
even get this far? Because people thought they knew the wallets, like Nansen had wallets labeled and everything, and I'm sure Chainalysis and all these big chain analysis companies are going to come out with blog posts saying like this is what they were doing, but it's a little late, you know. Like,
well, the best way to hide a wallet is to not have one, right? Yeah. So that's apparently what we've learned here, that they had such a small team that they were stretching these people so thin, feeding them soy and feeding them caffeine or uppers or whatever, and they broke, you know, and they started making bad trades, which they could get away with in a bull market. As soon as the market turned, the bets that they had made, it's gambling, they blew up, and then that cross-contaminated everybody. It's kind of the same thing that happened to the Luna Terra thing. It's like, once if you have to defend the peg, you know, for a stable coin or anything else, and you have to plow other assets into it that are not that denomination, then once faith runs out in crypto, it is gone, and things break, and they break downwards like 30-40% in hours because they can. And that's where, like, it's worked for Bitcoin in the past, because like the oscillations in the price or whatever, they drive a lot of interest. And because those oscillations, as they're on an uptrend, they get everybody curious and they say, oh, I really want to learn, why is this going up? Why was this $500? Now it's 1,000. And then obviously it dips down to 800 and you know, people are like, oh, well, okay, now's the time to buy because it was at 1,000, so it could hit 1,000 again. And there's just all these different like emotional mindsets that people go through. And it's so fascinating for me. You know, it's super fascinating because you contrast that with like the sort of slow pace. I'm using finger quotes now for anybody listening, the slow pace of the NASDAQ or something like that. But we've seen that decouple as well. So we're in massive decoupling from Bitcoin. And it's like there's Bitcoin and tech stocks. And now there's not that. Now there's Bitcoin and crypto. Now there's not that. So we're seeing all these things like kind of really peel apart. And, you know, when you dissect an entire industry like everyone's doing now, all of us are suddenly Perry Mason looking at stuff on chain world. Like, oh, we found this stuff.
Like, yeah, but some of us like this is some of us spend our day.
It's awesome. No, I love it. Stuff, right? That's what I'm saying. It's great. It's there's so many resources that we have that we can actually find out all this stuff. Right. So it's kind of like the Wall Street Bets deal, but like on a whole nother, you know, like on a predator scale. Like, you know, you have a guy like running and then you got like the laser on the shoulder and like the claws. Like, we can all be the predator now with the amount of data that there is, you know, versus where we were at 10 or 15 years ago in the traditional equities market. So it's a very exciting time to be a Bitcoin investor or a trader, because you know there is alpha to be a good. If you're good at it, you can do pretty well, at least in terms of accumulating Bitcoin. You might not be able to pay for your house, you know, because the dollar value of Bitcoin has gone down a lot. But I definitely have more Bitcoin today than I did weeks ago or months ago or whatever. So I'm not really complaining because it's still my savings account in that regard. So I'm just looking at Bitcoin denominated savings. That number keeps going up. I'm okay with that. I know that the, you know, as things go, the lesson is, it's okay to sell some of your Bitcoin at the top or buy some stuff at the top, you know, if you feel like it's necessary for your life. Obviously don't sell all of it, but like, you know, I wish I would have spent more Bitcoin when it was at 60 grand. Lesson learned. I spent some at 40. That was okay. But now that it's 16, I don't want to spend any of it, right? If it's 17, I don't want to spend any of it. I just want more Bitcoin. And I have faith that because Bitcoin works, this is where everyone's going to land. They don't have a choice. Like, that's it. It's
the, you're the funny thing about spending habits, though, is people assume like, oh, this is deflationary. No one's ever gonna spend it. But when you look at the actual data, people do exactly what you just illustrated in that they spend more when it goes up and they spend less when it goes down. So like the disinflationary, deflationary stuff doesn't really come across people's minds because there comes a point in time for everybody when it makes more sense to spend it than to hold it forever, right?
Yeah. I mean, forever is a really long time. And the whole like hyper Bitcoinization thing, like we're talking about Bitcoin. So if no one's ever heard that term before, let me define it really quick. Hyper Bitcoinization is what we believe is when Bitcoin goes to such a high value that a sat is effectively, you know, valuable. So if we get to sat cent parity, meaning 100 sats is worth $1, Bitcoin's price would be about $1 million at that point. So if that's the case, that would be great for anybody that has one Bitcoin. They would be a millionaire in fiat terms. But the thing is with that, obviously, there's, you know, how well are you keeping track of it? Is it on an exchange? Do you have control of it? Is it hidden? Are you like
with a custodian that
yeah,
exactly. regulated and trusted? And,
you have it split up so that you have, so nobody knows how much you have, you know, some things like that. So there's this whole other layer to being a Bitcoiner that all these people are now getting into because the flames and the pain of this blow up and these blow ups, right? Celsius, Voyager, all this stuff the last couple of months. It's going to make better Bitcoiners out of everybody. And like it or not,
get rid of the ones that don't. I mean, there are people that got hit by literally every single thing.
Yeah.
They got hit by Anchor, they the Luna thing, they got hit by Celsius, they got hit by FTX, right? And eventually, sadly, those people aren't going to be with us, right, much longer, because if they lost everything.
Well, there's that Doors song, or I think it's the Doors, and it's like, you know, not everybody gets out alive. So that's the way it is. And the goal for all of us as Bitcoiners should just be to give enough Bitcoin to the people down the line, or show our people down the line, whether that's your kids or your friends or your charitable organization or whatever. Hey, if something happens to me, don't lose my Bitcoin, right? This is how you can do something with it. So I think there's still so much upside to where, you know, we can see Bitcoin being this great thing. All these other currencies are going through hyperinflation, Turkey, Lebanon, stuff like that. And you'd rather be on a Bitcoin standard there. You need less money if you have Bitcoin and it stays flat and your fiat currency tanks. The dollar has been strong because it's the least worst of everything. You know, the dollar is sort of like the Bitcoin of fiat currencies, I guess. But I think still we're seeing this thing happen where you get these, it's like a sponge, right? You squeeze the sponge, liquidity comes out, and then you put it back in the water and you see the absorption, you see how much capacity it really has. And I think Bitcoin is going to have the capacity to absorb all of the tears and all of the pain and all the brokenhearted people. They can start stacking sats and then they can join us. Doesn't matter how broken and hurt you are, you can still buy Bitcoin and still be a Bitcoiner. Even if you never have considered yourself one, we'll accept everybody, right? It's money for friends, enemies, loved ones, ex-girlfriends, you know.
it's a big tent.
It's a big tent, and the tent gets bigger. It's like the infinite hotel. Like, the more people that check in, the more space it has. So I feel good about where we're at. I feel good that Bitcoin's able to stay sideways while there's this massive blow up of the entire industry. You know, some of the other coins have gone down a lot worse, and they continue to go down because the it's a bank run, and the VCs are going to dump and they're going to protect themselves so they can reinvest in the next Theranos or you know, whatever it is. They need their liquidity too, so we just have to maybe stop spending our time dunking on everybody and just continue to stay in the periphery and shoot some three-pointers like Corey. So Corey from Swan won his own 3-point contest, which is sort of funny. He iced it with like a Steph Curry-ish 29-footer the other day at the conference, which I thought was funny. But I would say overall, the vibes at the conference, back to that again, were positive because other people were there to talk about the Bitcoin signal. And it was about 1,000, 2,000 people. It was nice to have a conference on the West Coast because everything's like Miami all the time. But, you know, I think the industry is regulating itself. Mm-hmm. Right. And we're seeing.
But we still welcome common sense regulation. You know,
We need definition. We need common sense definition first so we can agree on the definitions. And I think that's the benefit of the Lummis-Gillibrand bill is they want to define certain things. So we can always tighten up definitions. And then, you know, you separate the centralized entities from the decentralized coins. And, you know, that's the first step. It's like I was talking to my wife today about politics. This is somewhat inflammatory, but I said, listen, if you're going to vote for somebody, the best heuristic as the first one is to say, is this person good for where I live? That's it. Like, is this person good? I live in California. Are they good for California? Or are they bad for California? And that's up to us to make that determination. But I think that's sort of how the government is going to look at this stuff. Is this coin, you know, decentralized or centralized? That's the first question they ask. And depending on, it's like, if yes, move to the next section. If no, list these things. And I think that's what they want. They say, if you're Solana and you've got this many, you know, validators, you've got this many entrants, you get this many pre-mined coins being held by this many entities, who holds what? Is there an unlock schedule, an unwind schedule, something like that? Disclose that stuff. Disclose that to Gary, you know, and if not, then, you know, we're going to make it hard on the people. They can't really stop the coins. They can't stop the blockchain itself, but they can make the people that are participating in that deal with a lot of pain. And I think that's what they're going to try to do. And I think we saw that with like the library token thing. They put up a fight. They lost. You know, the judge basically ruled in favor of the SEC, so that might happen again. I don't think the SEC is going to make 10,000 lawsuits out of this. I think there might be, you know, 20 or 30 that make sense, and then they'll be high enough profile that the exchanges will start taking less risks and not listing so many tokens that they feel could be potentially creating them as a target. The exchanges don't want to be targeted. So if the exchanges are willing to jump through all the hoops, you know, then that's going to be, I think, ultimately what creates a de facto or a de jure legislation or a regulation or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, we need something. Obviously, we don't want to overburden some regulation, but I think a lot of people have some great ideas as far as what we need to do to push in the right direction.
We have a lot of conversations to have. There's a lot of people that need to be educated because people are still going to conflate. You know, people still talk about what happened with Mt. Gox or Silk Road. And those were 6, 7, 8 years ago, 10 years ago, almost
10, 11 years ago.
Yeah. Right. So, you know, it also just goes to show you that people really don't forget good stories. And the Silk Road story and the Mt. Gox story, those are good stories. And I think in Bitcoin, the series, which I think would have to be like on Apple TV, 5 seasons, something like that, you know, you have all these different parallel timelines, like True Detective style, right? You have the cypherpunks, you have the dark web, you have, you know, centralized exchanges, you have, we'll call it price action or whatever you want to call it, Wall Street involvement, Saylor, Bukele, you know, Tesla, like Mass Mutual, all these other different stories that have come up. And I think there's a lot of, it's compelling. There's a lot of interesting characters in the space, and it's not going to stop because, you know, mass adoption involves everybody, weirdos, straight, normal people, right? Exchanges, technologists, regulation, international politics. I mean, it really is this crazy Terminator octopus that's just got all these different directions going at the same time. And, you know, it's like you think you can chop one of these arms off and it's just going to grow back. It's not going to stop. It's just going to keep going. And you might limit the reach of certain types of aspects of Bitcoin, but you're never like, they're never going to stop it. You know, if all these things blowing up doesn't slow down adoption, then nothing's going to slow down adoption. That's the way I look at it.
Yeah, and I think we'll leave it there for today. One last thing I'll just say is I was looking at the new addresses on the Bitcoin network over the past week, and we've gone from what was it? You know, plus 40,000 a day, 50,000 a day in new addresses. So, you know, not only is it people moving stuff around, but it's, again, it's people self-custodying hardware wallets, getting stuff off exchanges. This is all good things at the end of the day.
Yeah. Give us your weak, your weary, you know, we'll adopt all of you. We'll take all of you in. Josh, thanks for your time today. As always, I really appreciate your insight and your expertise and your historical perspective. I would say that maybe we should do like a tweet thread about some of these things and sort of link them up, the tortoise versus the hare. Maybe we can write something together on Google.
Yeah, that'd be good. That'd be good.
So, all right, buddy. Thanks, everybody, for listening to the Bitcoin Bottom Line. We are available always on the internet. And stay careful. Stack sats. Definitely take custody of whatever crypto you have. It's a better way to live your life.